The Rising Coaches Podcast is brought to you by Connor Sports. Connor Sports is the industry leader in sports surfaces. As you're watching the NCAA tournament this month, take a look at the courts. Those are Connor Sports. That's right, they're the official court of the men's and women's Final Four. They have floors all over college basketball. They got floors all over the NBA. If you need a new court for your facility, whether it's a big-time college facility or rec center, Connor Sports is who you want to see. Connor Sports, where champions play. Thank you for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon. And today we have a great episode for you. Brandon Rosenthal is just 29 years old and is already an assistant coach for the Northern Arizona Suns of the NBDL. Let me say that again. Brandon Rosenthal is 29 years old and is already an assistant in the D-League. How does that happen? Did he play in the NBA? Did he work for a Hall of Famer like Mike Krzyzewski or Rick Pitino? No, he didn't do any of those things. In fact, he played 1 year of Division III basketball and got his start as a D2 GA. So how does a guy like this end up as an assistant in the D-League before his 30th birthday? He's going to tell you. And after you hear his interview, you will probably think a lot of his story is luck. But it's not. He's just really modest. Brandon's one of the best networkers I've been around. And what makes him so good at it? That he's extremely down to earth. Nothing about him is fake. He's just really, really good at staying in touch. Hope you enjoy. And we hope to see you at the Final Four Social if you're down there in Phoenix. All right, joining us today is Brandon Rosenthal with the Northern Arizona Suns of the NBDL, the Development League. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, excited to be on. Obviously, a big fan, and appreciate everything that Rising Coaches does and what it's all about. So, to be a part of something like this is fun. I'm excited about it.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. All right, Brandon, you're from Tucson, Arizona, and you went to St. John Fisher College in Rochester, New York. Why would you do that, Brandon? I looked at the weather right before I called you, and today's March 10th, and in Rochester, New York, it's 20 degrees, and in Tucson, Arizona today, it's 91.
Well, everybody thought I was crazy for it. Even Coach Cornicker at the time thought I was a little crazy. I remember calling him, telling him I'm coming, and he was like, really? All right. Awesome.
So you played for a year, got hurt, and then – talk to your coach and kind of join the staff as a manager, student assistant. Is that right?
When I ended up getting hurt, Coach Cornicker took me out to dinner and he goes, Brent, I can tell how frustrated you are trying to get back into things. He goes, I'll stick with you. If you want to keep trying to get yourself back in shape, keep giving it another chance. I've got your back and let you do that. But, I also promised you an opportunity when your playing career was over with. And so when he told me that, it was kind of like the light bulb went off. Like, you know what, every time I go back into the gym, I feel like I'm taking myself, two steps backwards. And so I was like, maybe this is the right thing to do. Give it a shot and try the coaching thing. I was so passionate about it. At the time, and looking back, it was like the best thing that could have ever happened to me, because as anybody that's trying to break into the business, there's just kind of that period of time where you're trying to build a network and you're trying to meet as many people as you can. And so I got to start doing that as an undergrad. And on top of that, coach being such a, good guy and, having confidence in me and, really knowing who he was as a coach and, what he could get out of me, he just threw me into the fire. And so, by my the summer going into my junior year, took me out to Vegas to go recruit and going to AAU tournaments and making recruiting phone calls and each of the assistants that I worked with while I was at Fisher, you know, same thing, just threw me into the fire. You know, helping out with scouting reports, helping out with game prep. And so for me, it was kind of an opportunity to really just figure things out on the fly, learn, you know, A, was this really something I wanted to do? B, what I was good at, what I was comfortable with. And then just, you know, again, try to kind of take those steps forward that I think everybody, you know, at some point or another goes through. So luckily, looking back, that opportunity really kind of set me up for what followed. So, and the good thing about being at a small school too is you get to wear a lot of different hats. It was such a good learning experience for me, and a great opportunity. So, you know, I definitely was appreciative of it and learned a lot from the experience.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I was a manager at a Division II school, University of Tampa. And like you said, you just get thrown into the fire. And I've been around a lot of D1 programs and managers at that level. You certainly, I think, are around more people with bigger staffs, and maybe you get a little head start on your network. But at the small college level, man, you get such an unbelievable foundation of, like, knowledge and experience of actually, like, getting to do stuff that you wouldn't do at a Division I.
No question. I don't know. Maybe you might have went through this too. I learned, I think, my teaching style and my coaching style and my coaching voice that I have now really actually developed from those 2 years of my junior and senior year of college. You know, when you're the same age and, you know, shoot, 6 months ago you were trying to compete with these guys and practice every single day, to walk into the gym and then, you know, try to start coaching, you really have to learn how to walk that kind of that fine line in terms of being somebody that, you know, technically your teammates will respect and take your opinion, but also, you know, toe the line with being on the coaching staff. And, you know, there's things that are discussed behind closed doors that, you know, I had to be prepared not to share with my teammates, and there were things that my teammates were saying about the coaching staff. I had to kind of figure all that out. And at the same time, you know, if there was something that I had heard or I saw that could really help a teammate, knowing how to speak to them in a way that, you know, they'd be, you know, humbled enough to like take that and run with it and use it to their advantage, instead of trying to kind of go in and tell guys what to do. I think, that was a huge learning experience. And like I said, it's kind of really helped me and shape who I am as a coach at this point in my career too.
So after you finish up and you graduate, you jump on with the Rochester Razor Sharks of the PBL. The PBL, is that the Professional Bowling League? What is the PBL?
We're going to get phone calls from everybody in the PBL.
No, I looked it up. I was surprised to see it still exists. It's a minor league, basically, basketball organization, right?
Yep, the Premier Basketball League. Yeah, it was, again, very similar experience. You know, at that point, again, I knew I wanted to get into coaching. I was just finishing up my senior year of college. And I don't know, Rochester is a, they like to call it the minor league capital of the country. And so, for me, I was like, okay, I got to build the resume. All I have is my experience really with Fisher and, working as many camps as I could during the summertime. So I'm like, let me see if I can get something else on the resume. And so one of the assistant coaches had been a Fisher alum, Chris Iverson. I reached out to him and, you know, he didn't really know what to expect of me and he didn't really have a plan yet. But he just said, you know what, come on in, we'll find something for you. We could always use, you know, more help around here. So, show up to a practice. I think all I did was rebound and stand on the sideline. And I think there's a game like the very next day. I show up for the game and I'm wearing a suit, but I go and sit behind the bench. And, Coach Rod Baker, who's very well known, very well respected right now, he's a scout with 76ers and about as good a person as you'll ever meet. He looks at me and goes, what are you doing? Coach, I'm here for the game. And he goes, no, you're sitting up here, and puts me at the front of the bench. And that's where I sat for the rest of the season. And just like Coach Kornaker, just always threw me in the fire and told me that I could be around and be involved as much as I wanted. And so for that entire season, I tried to be at every single practice, even if it meant missing some classes to finish up my senior year. and be at every single one of the games. And that is that was minor league sports at its finest. So it was a neat experience, and learned a lot from that coaching staff and those players too. You know, they also embraced me and gave me a great opportunity as well. So yeah, it was that was an eye opener for sure.
You mentioned Rod Baker was the head coach. Remember that name. That name's going to come up later in our conversation here. And it's funny how these things work out and come full circle. But your next stop was St. Edward's. You were a GA St. Edward's in Austin, Texas. You start making your way back to warmer weather. So I didn't know you at this time. This is before I had met you. But my first introduction to you was you would send out, was it like monthly or maybe weekly newsletters or kind of play of the day? Is that what it was? Do you remember that?
Yeah, you know, oh my goodness, that seems like 10 years ago, but really I guess it wasn't that long ago. But yeah, that was something I was doing.
What was it you were sending?
I did both. I would send out a play of the day, and would send out a monthly newsletter. What I figured out was if I was constantly sending these emails out, I'd send it primarily to like AAU coaches. So when you go to these tournaments, they give you these booklets. I'd go through and I'd send these emails out to every single coach that had their name listed and their email address listed. And eventually I just would start including people that I had met, you know, at the Final Four or, that I had email exchanges with. And before you knew it, I was sending out an email to 1,000 different people with just this play of the day or this newsletter. And it actually became a great way to find out about kids, you know, potential student athletes across the country. So and met a ton of people doing that. So that was, that's not a surprise to me. I totally forgot all about that.
No, I love that because, you know, coaching, like anything, it's all about, you know, who you know. And I feel like some people go through their careers and, you know, some people don't try to make a name for themselves. They just do their job and keep their head down and keep moving forward. And then some people try to make a name for themselves, but they do it, you know, the wrong way and they self-promote and, you know, try to attach themselves to players. And then here you are, you know, making a name for yourself by just sharing knowledge, you know, talking hoops and, you know, here's a play that I saw that I really liked. And, you know, it was great. And I didn't know you, but I knew from that here's a guy that, you know, is really driven and organized and, you know, loves basketball. So I know we hadn't talked about that, but that was an unbelievable little thing you did and a great way to kind of separate yourself from the bunch, especially when you're, you know, when you're a GA, you get the 2-year clock in your head, like in 2 years, I'm going to need to find a job.
I do that job. Yep.
And that was a great way to kind of separate yourself from the group.
I totally forgot that. And there's a lot of people still doing that now. So I smile every time I get one of those emails or, you know, scroll through it and click on the different links, whether it's articles or it's you know, playbook video highlights or something like that. So, I totally forgot about that. That was definitely something I tried to do every single day. So
that's great. So 2 years at St. Edward's, and then you get your 2-year clock runs up, and you land a job at Santa Clara with Kerry Keating. And this is where that name Rod Baker, the head coach of the Rochester Razor Sharks, comes back into play, right?
Yeah, and again, it's so funny how things work out. Most people that try to break into the business, if you weren't a, you know, big time former player or anything like that, I was reaching out to a ton of different schools, and you know, I'd been a Division III player. I just worked at Division II, so I was really intrigued by Division I. When you grow up in Tucson, Arizona, you can't help but be an Arizona Wildcat fan as well. So you know, the interest of working in Division I was there. And so those were primarily the schools I was targeting to get in touch with and try to get my first job. And so it was a whirlwind. There was actually a job that was offered. I won't go into too much detail about it, but there was a job that I was offered. Had made all the plans in the world to move out there. The only thing I hadn't done yet was buy a plane ticket. I had found a place to live, figure out a way to get my car out there. Just hadn't bought a plane ticket. And that day, one day, I get a phone call that says, "Hey, sorry, we can't hire you. We got to hire somebody else. You know, according to our athletic directors, you know, it is what it is." And 15 minutes later, I get a phone call from Jesse Pruitt. Jesse, somebody I worked with for 3 years at Santa Clara, and now is an assistant at Stanford. And Jesse, I had met sitting next to at a Final Four my senior year of college. Coach Korniker, when I was an undergrad, would take the coaching staff always out to the Final Four every year, and he gave me his two tickets to go with his son. So we're sitting there, and of all the people that I could have sat next to, I'm sitting next to Jesse Pruitt. So you know, watching the two semifinal games, get to know Jesse really well, and stayed in touch with him for, you know, the rest of my senior year of college, and then my 2 years of grad school. And so my resume had made it to Jesse. They had just had a position open. Actually, Adam Bauman, that was who it was leaving to come join you at Mississippi State. And so Jesse, you know, had recommended or suggested, you know, that I reach out to Coach Keating and make sure that my resume gets to him, that he thought it might be a good fit for everybody. And so, so I sent my resume over to Coach Keating, and, apparently, Coach Keating starts going through my resume, and he sees the Rochester Razor Sharks, Rod Baker. And, you know, fast forward to when, or rewind back to when, Coach Keating was in college. One of the assistant coaches that he played for at Seton Hall was Rod Baker. And so, so Coach Keating calls Rod Baker and, you know, asked him about me, and Coach Baker to this day, still gives me a hard time. Just, he basically calls me, leaves me a voicemail and says, just don't screw it up. And so the next week I interviewed with Santa Clara, and a couple weeks later, ended up taking a job there as their video coordinator. So kind of, again, a small world and connections and relationships and how things kind of fall into place.
We touched on it a little bit earlier, but I always thought the biggest difference from going to from like Division II or junior college to Division I is now you're part of a big staff, 6-7 people on the staff, GA, video coordinator, ops guy, and then your assistants. And Coach Keating had some great staffs there. I don't know if all these guys were there when you were, but Dustin Kearns, Jesse Pruitt, Jason Ludwig, Adam Bowman. What was it like being part of a big staff and some really, really good basketball minds there at Santa Clara?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head here. One of the funny things for me when I was finishing up grad school and going through the interview process with a bunch of different coaches, they were all very concerned. You know, again, the jobs I was interviewing for were for video and ops positions, not for assistant coaching positions. And going from, you know, my time as an undergrad to my time as a GA, I'd been wearing an assistant coaching hat. I'd been out on the road recruiting and been on the floor and doing scouting reports. And so, Coach Kearns and Coach Keating, the very first couple of questions that they asked me had to do with, like, can you really see yourself going from being on the road and recruiting to being in a, you know, video coordinator position where you're not going to get to do any of that? And so my mindset was, well, maybe for me, it might be taking a step backwards to hopefully get to take, you know, two steps forward down the road. And so it was definitely an eye opener. And I've kind of gone through that again later in my career of when there's so many people that are a part of the staff, it really just comes down to like, just do your job and be great at your job. And that was definitely a challenge my first year, you know, not getting to be on the floor and coach and not getting to go out on the road and recruit. And so, you know, not only did I have to learn how to handle that piece of it, but also do the job. And there's definitely a level of professionalism, that's kind of, expected of you when you have a staff that size, you know, especially like if your only responsibility is getting the video scout done, for that day, then it better be really dang good. Where, you know, if you're at a smaller school, you know, the video scout might be the 10th thing on your list of things you got to get done that day. So it might not be as in depth. It might not be as, you know, as long, might not be as clean. So little things like that, you know, weren't huge adjustments, but definitely things I had to learn, and definitely figure out.
Yeah. I thought it was a big adjustment as well, but I also thought it was so much fun to like go from being, you know, I coached at a junior college. I was the only person on staff, myself and the head coach. And then you go and you're part of a 7-8 person staff, and you know, the conversations you have and the basketball, you know, chalk talks you have in the office, and just being around some like-minded people was really kind of fun for me. It was the first time I got to be a part of that.
Oh, for sure.
What was Coach Keating like? How was it working for him, and what kind of made him tick, and what was he really good at?
Yeah, I loved working for Coach Keating. Coach is probably one of the most organized people I've ever been around. Coach probably, and really did, script out, you know, everything from how the towels should be set up on the bleachers to, you know, how the scouting report's supposed to be executed and organized. Like, just literally from top to bottom, whether it was travel, whether it was camps, he had it scripted out. He knew how he wanted things done. And I think at my first year at Santa Clara, it might have been his fourth or fifth year. So it wasn't like I was coming in when it was, his first year as a head coach. So I know at that point he knew how he wanted to do things. But he's so organized. What a lot of people I don't think know about him is how much he cares about helping people. And he cares, about probably the student and the person, probably a lot more than most people do, as opposed to, the basketball player. Like he's all about seeing a guy, do what he's supposed to do in the classroom, do what he's supposed to do off the court, way before he ever thinks about the basketball piece of it. And so, that's why it was a really great fit for a place like Santa Clara. I mean, Santa Clara is a special university, and, Cary really fit kind of what that university embodies. So I was really lucky to work for a guy like him. And like I said, he was somebody that he always knew how he wanted things done. Like he always saw the problems before they really happened. And a lot of it had to do, he'd always tell me this, he goes, Brandon, you're going to appreciate, being the video coordinator. You're going to appreciate being the ops guy because, when you end up getting to be a head coach one day, you're going to know what you want out of those positions. And it's so much better than, skipping steps, because a lot of people end up getting jobs before they're ready for it, but they don't know how to manage a staff, or they don't know what responsibilities to delegate to people. And he was really good about always kind of, looking back at how are things being delegated, who has what responsibilities, can we clean this up, can we be more efficient, how can we manage our time. And so from an operations standpoint, I learned a great deal from him. And he's also, he puts together a phenomenal scouting report. One thing, like historically, if you played against Santa Clara teams, the team would always get really good at the end of the season. And a lot of that I attribute to, one, he was somebody, his philosophy as a staff, and it's funny, we were just talking about this the other day, here with Northern Arizona Suns. Like, do you teach guys everything at the beginning of the season? You dump everything on them. And then that way they're able to kind of make connections as they're going throughout the season. So it might be teaching the guys every single defensive coverage we might have. And then maybe you don't use it again until you get into conference play. And so we'd always get really, really good at the end of the season. And a lot of that had to do with, at the end of the year, he could really just lock in on the basketball piece of it. You know, the staff at that point and the team at that point would be running on all cylinders. And when he really locked in on an opponent, he was really good at finding ways to expose the opponent's weaknesses and take advantage of playing to our strengths. So, he really opened my eyes up to like how the operation should look, how to be a true professional, and how to kind of just navigate the profession. So he knows everybody. He's been in the business for a really, really long time. Very likable, and so I was very very blessed and fortunate to have worked for him for about 3 years.
Brandon, I want to go back to something you just said, and we'll get back to Santa Clara in a minute, but I thought it was really interesting. Just talking about when you get started with your season, you mentioned you like to dump all the information on them at the beginning and kind of sounded like you were saying kind of feel your way through it and get really good by the end of the year. You know, that's an interesting thing because we've talked about it here on our staff. Is that what? How is that compared to – is it almost – is that better than – getting really good at something first and then moving on to the next thing.
Yeah, you're spot on. And to be completely honest with your question, we were talking to staff, none of us have the answer yet. I think there's pros and cons to both. You know, I think one of the pros to, like we just said, dumping everything on the guys at the beginning of the season is that now maybe you're making just little tweaks and stuff. It's almost like a training camp. You know, in the D League and in the NBA, you've got your, you know, hopefully like 5 days of training camp, and then you're hitting it, hitting the ground running with games, and it's really hard to practice, and it's really hard to kind of put new things in, and so your system has to be in place. Where in college, you have so many more days of practice that, you know, maybe you just start with the basic structure of what your system is, and then you start adding more detail as you go. So, but for whatever reason, at Santa Clara and talking to other staffs that dump everything on the guys at the beginning of the year, they always seem to peak at the end of the year. And it's almost because, you know, as teams start making adjustments to their systems and or you play a team in the NCAA tournament, whatever it may be, you've already kind of gone over, you know, what that defensive coverage might be and how to rotate out of it, where, you know, some teams, if they're only prepping for this first time to do something like that, guys aren't used to it. They haven't put in the time. They haven't practiced that before. But again, the struggle or maybe sometimes the negative of that is you might get off to a slow start at the beginning of the season. And if you have a young team and you have guys that are obviously inexperienced and need to learn to just be really good or really great at one or two things, sometimes that can cost you some games. So in college basketball, you don't really have that luxury. You know, every game has, you know, so much pressure to it, and every game counts so much in so many different areas, where, you know, at this level and at the NBA level, you know, if you lose a game or two, it's not the end of the world if you're trying to teach the team, you know, how to do certain things and how to grow as a team. So what did you guys come up with kind of having that same type of conversation?
Well, I don't have the answer either, but I'm always in awe of, like when I watch Northern Iowa, they hedge every single ball screen and they do it to perfection. And I sit there and think, man, they must sit there the first month of practice and just work on hedging ball screens, hedging ball screens, hedging ball screens. And then I look back to our practices and I think, well, where do you find the time to do that? You got to put in zone offense, zone defense, press offense, press defense. You know, there's so much to cover. Like you said, before the first game, you know, the time is limited. And it's always, you know, finding that balance. Do you just get great at one thing first and then move on to the next? Or do you kind of just make sure you get everything in there by your first game so that you're prepared for more situations, but maybe you're not really, really good at one thing? You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know that anyone has the answer. There's different ways to skin a cat, but
no question.
Something that's always – I found interesting.
We spent a good 2 hours in the office talking about it and talking about, you know, how we would have maybe done things differently in the preseason and in our training camp, and you know, how we might do things differently next year, and, you know, where you start, and, you know, when you introduce certain things, and, you know, how much of that has to do with how your roster is. You know, what's the makeup of your roster? Are these returning players? Are these guys that are all rookies? We have a very young team with the Northern Arizona Suns, and so some of our challenges have had to deal with you know, teaching young players how to play the game. So I can only imagine. You're right. I think there's a lot of different ways to go about it.
All right, getting back. Sorry, I got us off topic. Getting back to Santa Clara, you go there as video. You get bumped up to ops. You guys have some success there. You win the CBI. Your fourth year at Santa Clara, or going into your fourth year, I guess, there's some movement on the staff. And, you know, I think, you know, if I remember back to talking to you around this time, it seemed like you were kind of getting the itch to get back on the court and get back on the road. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You had spent three years kind of behind the desk and in ops roles and video. And you kind of got that opportunity, at least in an interim role, between, you know, coaching movement on your staff, and got to do some summer workouts and summer recruiting, right?
Yeah, and it was awesome. It was great to be back on the floor. I think anybody that's gone through that experience can relate to it. It was rejuvenating, and it was good to kind of find your voice again. And that was one of the best summers that I, you know, in terms of my experience at Santa Clara.
So then you make the jump, and you do it kind of late. But you make the jump from college to the NBA, and you get a job with the Houston Rockets. Assistant video coordinator, is that right?
Yep.
And you get hired in October, which I know the NBA always hires later than college. You know, I always seem to hear that NBA jobs get filled kind of in August and September. Yours goes down in October. How did that work?
They had had some movement on their staff. And had been looking for some guys, and I lucked out. Somebody on their staff by the name of Matt Brazzi, who I had grown up with, another Tucson, Arizona guy, had recommended my name. We had been talking earlier in the summer, and I told him that I was really excited about the opportunity at Santa Clara and being on the floor and. Having the opportunity to maybe, get out on the road and really recruit. And the one thing that he had mentioned to me during the summertime was that, if you ever had interest in the NBA, chances are you'd have to, again, start from the bottom and work your way back up. And so when I had gotten a phone call from their head video coordinator about a position with them, that was kind of weighing on my mind. I had never, ever thought about going to work in the NBA. I always wanted to be a college coach, loved college basketball, loved what it was about, loved the process of how college coaching goes and kind of the year-round calendar. But for whatever reason, that week when I got that phone call, it just seemed like, this might be the only opportunity I ever get. And I'm still young and, have nothing kind of holding me back, and why not jump at something completely new and just throw my hat into it and see what happens. And kind of big picture looking, I always felt like, well, even if it doesn't work out or I don't like the professional level, at least I gained this experience. And in some way, whether it's in recruiting or from just a basketball teaching standpoint, it's going to help me in college. And I can always go back to college. That was kind of my mindset at the beginning when I started to go through that interview process. But everything happened really quickly. They wanted somebody the first day of training camp. And so I think I got that phone call on like a Wednesday, accepted the job on like a Friday, and was out there, the next Monday. So literally like 72 hours later. So I had to ask some family members to come help me move out of my new place that I just moved into and kind of get situated and throw everything into a car and get out there. So it was definitely the right move and an unbelievable experience.
So you kind of already answered this question, but so this is not something that you hadn't had your eyes on the NBA and making that jump. It sounds like you just kind of had a connection, somebody from your past who was at that level that kind of reached out to you. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's funny because, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but it really opened my eyes my first week when I was in Houston. I watched NBA basketball, but I wasn't watching with kind of that coach's eye. Like I think I was watching NBA basketball with, more so from a fan standpoint. And so I didn't really understand the NBA game. I wasn't really paying attention to kind of what was going on a day-to-day basis throughout the league. And so I know my passion was nowhere in that direction going towards professional basketball, but obviously was intrigued by it and I'm always kind of curious, like, you know, how does the NBA training camp go? What is the difference between the NBA game and the college game? And what's it like in an NBA locker room and coaching, you know, professionals, coaching superstars, coaching the very best players on the planet? And so, again, it was kind of one of those moments where, I don't know when this opportunity would ever come up again, just because it hadn't. I had never even, you know, like I said, pursued something like this. So to take the opportunity kind of felt like, you know what, maybe I give this a shot and see where it leads.
Tell me about your typical day as a video coordinator with the Rockets, because I hear stories about NBA video coordinators, and you know, you hear stories. This is at least how I vision it in my mind, is you sit in a small storage closet with like three or four racks and servers and no windows, and you just sit there for 8 hours and cut up games. I'm sure it's not like that, but
it is like that.
Yeah, I'd imagine with all the games you guys play, there's just so much film to be cut up. Take me through like a typical day and your duties.
Yeah, there's a lot of coffee involved. There's a lot of food involved. There's a lot of late nights, early mornings. A lot of jokes being told. You know, at some point you turn into a zombie and you don't know what day of the week it is. You hope that you're working with great people. And from a typical day to day standpoint, the cool thing about Houston, John Cho, who's anybody that's been a video coordinator in the NBA knows who he is. I think he's going on like year 19 in the NBA. Like, he's been around forever. And so John had really kind of set up the systems that, you know, the Rockets have in place in terms of kind of the workflow and how the front office and how the coaching staff uses video. And so having the opportunity to kind of go work for somebody like him and then Mitch Vanya, who had been at Texas A&M, he was a manager at Texas A&M, had been a GA at Texas A&M. So he knew the college game, kind of knew where I was coming from. And both guys basically told me, like, you know, we don't need you to be an expert in something like sports code. We don't need you to, be this absolute machine that can, you know, turn around and scout reports left and right. We need you to be able to be a good guy and get your job done and be able to have fun with us and fit into our culture. And, you know, I didn't really understand what that meant, but what ends up happening is you spend so many hours with these guys because, you know, unlike college, where there's always kind of somebody missing on the staff or somebody on the road recruiting, or maybe you get out of the office one day and you go walk around campus, or you've got different events going on campus or off campus. When you're part of an NBA staff, like, everything's done in the office. Maybe you go do a little bit of work from home, but you're going to spend from, you know, potentially like 7 a.m. till 9 o'clock at night with the same group of guys. And so the camaraderie that staff has to be on point, and guys have to enjoy working together every single day. And so most of the time it was at a computer, and it was cutting games, and it was putting different edits together. And then when the team would be practicing, it was our responsibility to be up on the court and help out any way that we could, anything that the coaching staff needed. And then at different points during the day, you know, players came in for individual workouts to be able to rebound and pass, maybe jump into a drill. So whatever it may be, kind of again, wearing a lot of different hats, very similar to like a manager role to a certain, aspect, but really just driven, focused in on basketball. And that's what I think kind of made it so special and unique for me, was every single day was basketball 24/7. And there were some days where, again, you turn into a zombie and you're trying to cut games up as fast as you can, and really you want to just be sitting there watching them while you're cutting, but you got to get the games done. It was only basketball. So, and on a college campus, oftentimes you're doing class checks, you're going to eat lunch with one of the players, something along those lines that you can't spend all your time on basketball. Where in the NBA, that's your job.
And it sounds like, you know, in college, a video coordinator, you're not allowed to be on the floor. Sounds like here, you know, that was almost encouraged for you to get out there and practice. And I mean, is that, if a player wants to come in for a workout and you want to get out there and rebound for him, is that like only if you get your film work done and you know, and you have time to get out there? Or is it like, hey, that's job, you know, number one, if one of these guys wants to get shots up?
One thing that I kind of had held, you know, I always thought if you do everything with putting the players first, like if every decision you made and you approach everything with that kind of mindset, you know, 99.9% of the time you were going to be right, you know, and everything was going to work itself out. And Coach Bickerstaff, who was our head coach, probably like 90% of the season, you know, he had talked to our video room and had told us, like, number one thing is taking care of the guys. Number one thing is looking out for the players and making sure they have what they need. And so if that means, you know, one of them trickles in at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning and wants to get shots up and you have an edit due by 9:30, well, pass it on to somebody else and get out there and rebound and get out there and help that player get better and be there for him. So that was the culture he wanted to create. And it was kind of the perfect culture to work in, but yeah, being on the floor, you know, and there were certain situations where you'd be the one, you know, running the workout. You know, if the coaching staff was on the road and, you know, a player was injured and, you know, needed to get shots up, and didn't happen to go on that road trip, that might be your responsibility for doing that. So, a lot of cool opportunities from a basketball standpoint, that unfortunately you don't get to have in college, because of the NCAA rules and stuff.
Well, so what is that like, when you're going out there and, you know, helping an NBA guy out with a workout? I mean, here you are, some guy that, you know, he doesn't know from anybody. You know, obviously you guys build a relationship, but most guys came from a Power 5 school and probably played for a legendary head coach in college and, you know, maybe he's been in the league for 10 years and you're, you know, in your 20s, you know, and like you said, 5'9", and got a year of D3 playing experience under your belt. You know, are you leading them through workouts? Are you sitting back and letting them tell you what they want to get done? How does that work?
That's a great question. You're spot on. I think the first thing you said was relationship. You know, those guys, the players, when they see you at every practice, getting them edits, taking a sincere interest in how they're doing, getting to know them as people, they'll let their guard down. I think one thing about professional basketball players is that it's their career. It's how they put, you know, food on their table. It's how they get their kids to school. Like that's what pays the bills. And so that guard that sometimes is up, usually comes down when you're on a basketball court, for most professional players. And so if you've shown over time that you have ways to help them get better, 9 out of 10 times they're going to listen to you and they're at least going to listen. They might not do what you say or they may not agree with you. But they're going to listen and try to listen to how you're saying it, what you're saying and what the point is that you're trying to make. And so, with each player that I had the opportunity to work with, all of them, the kind of that point where you get over that hill and okay, guys bought in, happened at different points. Some guys, it was day one. Some guys would just say, hey, you're the coach, you run the workout, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do, you know, go as hard as I can. And, you know, you kind of sit back and like, wow, really? Like that's, you know, that's awesome that, this guy has, you know, that kind of attitude and approach. And then, there are other guys where you're fighting through the workout a little bit. And so there's a little bit of a balance, and the best way to kind of get through that was getting to know those guys, off the court, or get to know those guys, you know, more, so spending more time with them, you know, whether it was in the locker room or spending time with them on the court during practice. So a little bit of both. But at the end of the day, it's really about building relationships with those guys. And once you've built that relationship, and you know, checking your ego at the door, I think that's the biggest thing and the biggest difference that I've noticed from, you know, being around college coaches, being around NBA coaches, you got to go to that workout with an open mind and know that it's, you know, it's two-way communication. And yes, you know, if you're the one running that workout, you know, there's certain things that need to get done and you express those with the player. But more times than not, if you're receptive of what they want to get done and what they want to be working on, what they feel like they need, that's how you make the workout as productive as possible. So it's a two-way street, and really it's having a relationship and having an open line of communication.
Do you latch on to the young guys? Are they a little more receptive? I would imagine, you know, if you're dealing with a 10, 15-year NBA vet, I would imagine you'd almost be learning more from that experience than they would be learning from you, just sitting back and watching their routine. Did you get a lot from the players just watching how they work and what they like to do? And did you try to impart that kind of to the younger guys? Or
that's another great question. I think, again, every player is different. A lot of veterans have their routine, you know, especially in season, they know what they want to do on a day-to-day basis. A lot of times it's just kind of maintenance work when they come to the gym. Maybe it needs to be a workout more driven to working, you know, their cardio and making sure that they're staying in shape if they're not getting a lot of minutes at the time. So it's whereas rookies, they might come into the workout having no idea what they need to be doing. And so it's kind of a little give and take, you know. And sometimes you'll run into a rookie who actually has a lot of who's put a lot of time into creating a routine and put a lot of effort into knowing what he has to do to be ready for the next game. So again, every guy is so different. And you know, I think before you even start the workout, it's that kind of communication, knowing the guy, like, you know, hey, this is what, you know, I think you need to get done today. And, you know, how's your body feeling? Where's your mind at? What did you want to get accomplished during this workout? And then kind of coming up with a plan together. So that's, you know, as efficient and as effective as possible.
What's the biggest difference in the players from the NBA level? Obviously they're better, but, you know, and is it just the size is overwhelming compared to the college game, the athleticism, the professionalism? What is it that really makes a guy an NBA player?
The part that stands out to me is their basketball IQ and how quickly they're able to learn. A lot of, you know, kind of the difference, I'll even kind of go into the D League a little bit. Guys that are in the NBA, a lot of the times, if you show them something, maybe you work on a new skill, a new type of pass, a new type of footwork or something like that, they might be able to do it in a game, you know, that very next day, 5 minutes on it, and they've almost mastered it. Whereas college, they might not get it through the entire season. D-League, maybe it takes them a couple weeks to get. So there's I think that might be the biggest difference to me, is how smart some of these guys are. I know our first scouting session, or pregame video session in Houston, we showed the guys one set right on film, and the guys knew how they were going to guard it without really walking through it. Without much discussion behind it, it was, hey, this is the type of action, and they knew what to do with it. And so to be able to show guys, you know, something like that, and for them to pick it up that quickly it's absolutely incredible to me. So I'd say the basketball IQ piece is the biggest difference that you start to find from guys, where they start to separate themselves. NBA players are basketball geniuses. They really are. And like you said, they've been around some incredible coaching, and they've been playing basketball for the majority of their lives. And so they're at some point, for a lot of these guys, there aren't too many things that they haven't seen before, or too many, you know, different experiences that they've really, too many new experiences that they've had. So that to really help guys grow and learn and develop at that point, you really are working in kind of to the smallest of details. And so at that point, again, too, you're talking about details that you might not really even be able to get to with a college player, because they're still developing their foundation. They're still developing their basics. And so that ability to then have it translate into a game is something pretty special.
So you guys had kind of a crazy year in Houston. You came in, you worked for Kevin McHale as the head coach. 5 games into the season, he gets fired. I mean, you talk about pressure. You think the pressure at the college level is bad. That's a whole nother level over there. And then they move up J.B. Bickerstaff, who took over and really did a good job and got you guys in the playoffs. And talk about J.B. and what made him so special.
J.B., one, he's got an incredible basketball mind. He also has an unbelievable ability to communicate. The way, like, I loved just being in practice or in pregame and or coaches meetings and just listening to him talk about the game. The way he uses terminology, the way he explains things to guys, or just talks about the game, it's special. Everybody wants to have that perfect flow and the perfect way of teaching things and that presentation. He's got that it factor. He's got an incredible defensive mind and he's got a great way about him just relating to the people that he's around. You know, he loves to have fun, loves to laugh, very laid back, easygoing. But you know, he's got a competitive fire to him. He's got a chip on his shoulder. So it was fun every day to go to work with him and for him. And, he did a great job in getting everybody moving in the same direction, getting everybody on board. And, one thing that I learned really quickly was like how important, again, you know, go back to my experience at Santa Clara, like how important it is to do a great job delegating. And he did a great job of that every single day and explaining to the staff what he needed from them. And, not just, you know, for example, the video room, but what he wanted from each of us individually. He made sure to always make you feel like you were appreciated. He did an incredible job. And again, like I said, I think very, very highly of him. I was very lucky to work for him.
Okay, so the season ends. Coach Bickerstaff doesn't get the job. And you get on with the Suns organization and their D-League team, the Northern Arizona Suns. How did that come about? Was that through connections you made in Houston?
A little bit of everything. I think the first connection was similar to my connection in Houston. There's somebody in the organization that I had known for a long time that I'd actually gone to high school with and grew up with.
You grew up with all these NBA coaches.
I know.
I need to move to Tucson.
Right? small world sometimes. One thing I learned, and really I was kind of able to reflect on it a lot this past season, is, you know, a lot of coaches they're hungry to get their opportunity, right? That first opportunity. They often think that they're more ready for a position, but sometimes their resume doesn't say that they're ready for the position. And one thing I learned, it was so key for me to get that job in Houston, because it now puts something on my resume to open up so many more doors. And like I said, I don't think I get the job in Phoenix with the Suns organization if I don't have that experience in Houston. And so, my good friend Lewis Lehman, who's with the Suns organization, I don't think he would have been able to put my resume down on anybody's desk without me having that opportunity in Houston. And you know, a lot of times, you know, I've experienced this with people that have reached out to me. You know, they want one particular job, and unfortunately, their resume doesn't say that they're ready for it. A lot goes into hiring, and sometimes the head coach has to appease an athletic director or university president. So regardless of relationship, regardless of whether or not, you know, they might be qualified or be the best candidate, sometimes if it doesn't fit on paper, sometimes you can't make that hire. And so, I was really lucky in that my resume kind of started to stack up where, you know, this was an opportunity that I could get myself involved with. So there were a lot of other people that I knew a little bit throughout the organization. Obviously a lot of the coaches in Houston did their very best to help me out, to get onto staff here. And then it kind of came full circle and ended up working itself out. But, like I said, I think one thing that a lot of young coaches make the mistake on is they don't stay in touch with people. So, you know, for example, when I was at Santa Clara and we were trying to hire a video coordinator, so many guys reached out to me. And unfortunately, you know, job only goes to one person. And then you don't hear from that, you know, that group of coaches ever again. When some of them, shoot, the next time that, you know, a position would have come open, would have loved to have reached back out to them. And so, kind of always stay in touch with people and following up and having those genuine relationships, I think is what has helped me out and kind of paid off and really paid off this past year. So, so it, you know, a little bit of a luck and being at the right place at the right time. And then obviously having a resume now that said, you know, that I could be hired for a position like that.
And you came into the Suns the same time that they hired Earl Watson, right around the same time they hired Earl Watson to be their head coach. So kind of a transition time for that whole organization. How much did you interact with the, you know, the Suns and Earl Watson and the front office there in Phoenix?
Yeah, the front office and, you know, and Earl especially have been great about embracing our coaching staff with Northern Arizona Suns. Earl has had a ton of experience in the D-League, you know, was an assistant in the D-League, and won a D-League championship. So he completely understands kind of the system and what's in place and what the D-League is all about. And so he had said from the get-go that he wanted our staff involved. He wanted our, you know, our organization, our team running, you know, similar offenses, similar defenses, and, you know, making sure that line of communication was always there.
So you're an assistant coach now with the Northern Arizona
interacting
Suns.
As one big
so I'd imagine that, you know, working
teams.
With guys on the floor and
so,
player development
so from
is one
day
of your
one,
main
duties. Our
what's
staff
that been
be
like?
Training camp.
In the D League, you know,
any
I imagine
that
you
we're
some,
able to make it down
some
to their
extra
games
credibility
or,
now
or
coming
go
straight
watch
from the
practice.
NBA.
You know, Earl Watson's involved as much as
it's been
much
so much
more
fun.
To do so,
you know, I think coaching staff there the in Phoenix has done a tremendous job with the NBA
making us feel part of the family.
It's actually,
you know, I think that's
college,
important
in some respects. These guys have we're in a small town in Prescott, Arizona, Prescott Valley, Arizona, but a lot of these guys with their contracts and the way things are set up. The amount of time that they can spend with us as coaches is so much greater than, you know, what really goes on in the NBA and really what can happen in college. You know, in college you have guys have to go to class and there's a you know, certain amount of, you know, hours you can spend on the court with guys. Here in the D-League, you know, player development is at the forefront of everything. To be quite honest with you, and I don't know if I'll ever say this again, but the player development piece is the number one thing. It's more important than winning. It's more important than anything else that goes on. It's really about helping these guys get better in every facet. And it's, to be honest with you, it's probably more so off the court than it is on the court, whether it's, you know, learning good eating habits, good sleeping habits, you know, learning how to become true professionals and giving them all the tools that they need in their toolbox. To ultimately, hopefully, play in the NBA or get a, you know, great contract overseas, and really set themselves up for the rest of their lives, so that, you know, if you know, hopefully they're all able to have long careers, but you know, to have made enough money that, you know, if they don't want to work and they just want to simply retire afterwards, they can do so. And so we're around guys, you know, 24/7, and you know, especially when we're on the road, and you know, whether it's watching film with guys, whether it's going out to eat with guys, there's so many different components to it. But I think maybe the best thing about it is the amount of time we all spend together, which, again, coming into it, I didn't know how that would all work and how it would all come together. And again, it goes back to the big picture of player development and what the league really stands for.
Brandon, I don't know if you can answer this and talk about your current guys, but is there anybody that's just stood out as somebody that you've sat back and said, man, he is really impressive, and I would not be surprised if he ends up in the NBA.
You know, I wouldn't say anybody in particular. You know, again, so much of it sometimes comes down to luck and being at the right place at the right time. You know, a lot of guys in the D-League, they're competing for that last spot on a roster, you know, maybe that third point guard position. But what I will say is that there's a lot of guys that come into the league that you saw in college. You know, we've got some guys that were in college even for 4 years, and so you already kind of have a predetermined notion of who they are as a player and you know, what their strengths and what their weaknesses are. And all of a sudden you get to work with them for, you know, a couple weeks, and the guy might go from, you know, maybe only shooting 23s as a senior to now all of a sudden he's made 23s after, you know, 8 games in the regular season. So little stuff like that where, you know, before the season started, people were telling you, man, if he could just add a jump shot, he might be an NBA player. And so that's kind of the fun part about being in the D League is you get to kind of see some of these stories happen where, guys have one thing, maybe two things missing from their game that are keeping them from having an opportunity in the NBA. And you work tirelessly, as a staff, as a team, to really help those guys, to improve and get better and, hopefully, you know, meet all their goals. And so that's, we definitely have a lot of guys on our team. We've got a special group of guys that are on that fringe of having an opportunity like that. And that's really what it comes down to.
Well, Brandon, one thing I want to say before we get off here is I really want to thank you for everything you've done with Rising Coaches. And you've really been a crucial part of our organization for the last 3-4 years. And there's no question we'd be able to operate at the level we do now and reach as many people and help as many people as we would without you. And you really have done a ton, and I feel like sometimes you don't get the credit you deserve. But I did want to thank you for everything you've done for Rising Coaches, and we're proud of you and excited to follow your career, and wish you the best of luck.
Adam, appreciate it. Obviously, the pleasure's all mine. It's you know, I feel like I'm a part of a great group of guys that are about the right things and love the coaching profession, love the game of basketball. And so it's always fun to get to catch up every year at the Final Four and stay in touch throughout the season. And, you know, I think the thing I look forward to most is watching a lot of the guys that I've met through Rising Coaches play games. You know, anytime, you know, a fellow Rising Coach is on ESPN, cheer for those guys and root for them to see them be successful. So, you know, you and Trey have built up an awesome network and an awesome group of guys. It's given us all a platform to really all get to know each other and build something, you know, long-term throughout this profession. So it's been special.